The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Jim Cronin from the North Carolina Reading Service. Yes, we have changed our name. Officially, July 1st, we became the North Carolina Reading Service. The reason? Because we no longer are just serving the Triangle. We're serving basically the whole state here and there. For the next hour, I shall be reading from the Reader's Digest and Consumer Reports. If you have any questions or would like to become a sponsor, please contact our office at 919-832-5138. Okay, let's start off with inspiration in a Reader's Digest. Rescue Dog. I was morbidly overweight and disconnected from the world. So was Petey. And then we found each other. Any day that I had to go to the airport was the worst day of my life. And as a traveling appliance salesman, I had to fly quite a bit. On this day in 2010, I was assigned to a middle seat. I was so big I couldn't fit down the aisle facing forward, so I walked sideways, like a crab. I could see the other passengers' fear like cartoon thought bubbles above their head. Please, God, don't let that humongous guy be in the seat next to me. I was 5'10" and weighed between 340 and 360 pounds, the exact number depending on whether you took my weight before or after one of my gargantuan meals. When I finally squeezed into my seat, the seat belt wasn't long enough to fit around my 52-inch waist. They never were. The flight attendants say they had run out of seat belt extenders. They were going to have to get one from another plane. More than 30 minutes passed. "Great," said the slender man in the window seat next to me. "I'm going to miss my connection because you're so fat." I wanted to die right there in that seat. I wish my life would just end. I woke up the next morning knowing that I needed to change. I started looking for signs that might lead me toward a better life, and immediately a sign showed up. I turned on the TV and happened to catch an interview with former President Bill Clinton. He looked fit and full of energy, about half his former size. He said he'd been under the care of a doctor who put him on a whole food plant-based diet. That was all it took, he said. He lost weight without feeling hungry, and he was healthier and stronger than he'd been since his 20s. I never imagined my sign would come from Bill Clinton, but here he was. I have no idea what a whole food plant-based diet was, but I ran with it, even though I couldn't actually run to save my life. I went online and searched for a doctor who could help me. I came across Pratiti Kuklakani, a naturopathic doctor. I wasn't sure what that meant, but I felt hopeful when she agreed to see me the next day. "So tell me about yourself," said Dr. Pretty, as she liked to be called. I told her I had type 2 diabetes, high cholesterol, high blood pressure, and was on all sorts of meds for those. "So stick to what I tell you. There's a good chance you won't need any of those in a few months," she said. "At every meal, just make sure that at least half your plate is full of fruits and vegetables, and the rest is beans or rice and any other food that is not from an animal. If you do that, you'll start feeling better. And with exercise, I think you'll be surprised how quickly things can change." Sorry about that. I kind of lost my tongue there for a second. "She suggested I start with 20 minutes of light exercise twice a day. Something you can enjoy, like taking a walk," she said. "I'd recommend that you go to a shelter and adopt a dog." "Exercise," I said. "A dog?" "A dog is good companion," she said. "Plus you live in an apartment, which means the dog has to be walked. So you walk your dog twice a day, and that will be your exercise." "I've never owned. What about a cat?" I asked. "Have you ever seen anyone walking a cat?" she said. And so on a few days later, I drove up to the Humane Society Silicon Valley in San Jose, California, near where I lived. I had already spoken with Cassandra, who was in charge of adoptions. She said she had the perfect dog for me, but she offered some advice. "Don't look him in the eyes at first." I knew that wouldn't be a problem. I had trouble making eye contact with anyone. "Just let him sniff your hand. Don't try to pet him right away. Just give him a second. He's a real sweet dog once he knows you." That didn't sound like the happy golden retriever I'd had in mind. And there's a picture of Mr. O'Gray at 340 pounds, and he is large. Cassandra stepped out of the room, and I took a deep breath. My heart was pounding. Then I heard footsteps approaching, dog nails on concrete. The handle on the door turned. The door cracked open. A black nose tried to push its way in. Then the door opened all the way. There he was, a large black and white dog with a big round body, shuffling into the room with his head hung low. He looked up at me and then dropped his head with a clear look of disappointment, like, "Really? The loser." I suppose I looked at him the same way. He's a border collie and Australian shepherd mix, to the best of our knowledge, Cassandra said. As you can see, he's middle-aged and overweight. And that means he's in need of a new routine, just like the one you told me you needed. Raider's out of shape. His joints are swollen. He needs to start walking again. Raider, I asked. Like the Oakland Raiders, his owners were fans. I looked at him, petting him in silence. I wonder how many other dogs had come through here, and I wonder how many other humans, like me, were skeptical of the whole dog-human matchmaking process. I didn't want to let Cassandra down. I thought, this is what she does for a living, and she feels really strongly about this. I tried to give her the benefit of the doubt. Why did someone give this dog up, I asked. Cassandra flipped through a few pages of notes on a clipboard. There was a divorce. He was not being cared for the way he needed. He spent a lot of time in a backyard by himself after his primary caregiver went off to college, and the family just felt like maybe there was a better home for him somewhere else. Raider sniffed my shoes. He looked up and I scratched him behind the ears. He seemed to like that. When I stopped for a moment, he lay down on the floor near my feet. Oh, look at that. He likes you already, Cassandra said. I have a good feeling about this. Just be patient. You have to understand that his whole life has been uprooted. It's going to take him time to adjust. The poor guy, I said. It hit me how tough this dog's life had been. I looked down at Raider, and suddenly the sadness in his eyes didn't look like a reflection on me. It more like he was just done and ready to give up and die. Like me. I started to tear up. Can I ask you something? I said to Cassandra. Can I change his name? I'm a 49ers fan. We hate the Raiders. Cassandra laughed. Yes, you can change his name. Might take him a while to respond, but why not? Fresh start. I named him Petey, after the dog in the Little Rascals, and we took it slow, just as my doctor and Cassandra had recommended. We had to. Petey weighed 75 pounds when a healthy weight for him was more like 50. But on our first walk together, Petey took the lead. We made it halfway down the block and then came back. Luckily for me, he didn't walk very fast. You could practically hear my footsteps on the sidewalk as I swung each leg forward. Thump, 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 like the giant from Jack and the Beanstalk. The next day, we made it to the end of the block. Soon it would lead me around the block. Then he wanted to keep going, and I would tag along. At the same time, I was following Dr. Preeti's instructions for plant-based eating. Maybe 5 or 6 days after eliminating animal products from my diet, I woke up feeling like a new person. I rolled out of bed with ease. My knees weren't sore. I had also put Petey on a vegan dog food. He appeared thinner and seemed to have a spring in his step. And he had stopped scratching all the time and shedding everywhere the way he had when I first brought him home. My second office visit with Dr. Preeti, I weighed 5 pounds less than the week before. I'm actually surprised it's not more, I said, because I feel different. I feel lighter. A few days later, I went to take Petey for his morning walk, and he backed right out of his collar. He lost so much weight that it slipped off. My pants were almost falling off me, too. I tightened my belt as far as it would go, but I realized that if my belt were to slip, my pants would fall to the floor. That would not look good in the middle of an appliance store. I needed to go clothes shopping, something I had avoided for years. I would have ordered clothes online, but I didn't know what size I was anymore. At Men's Warehouse, the bending and squatting, dressing and undressing, and the only tiny dressing rooms left me overheated and miserable. This wasn't a victory lap. It was awful. I bought 3 pairs of pants and a few shirts, and spent nearly $200. It felt like a ripoff. For the most part, what's available for men over 300 pounds is the equivalent of a muumuu, low-end, loud Hawaiian print shirts. Sitting on the couch that night, I thought maybe I would give it all up. Maybe I was too far gone. Then Petey jumped into my lap. He started licking my face, which made me laugh. I petted him, and he pressed himself into my belly and lay down on top of my thick thighs as if he were a tiny puppy snuggled up in a blanket. And then he looked up to me as if I were the greatest guy in the world. "Oh, Petey," I said, "are you sure you're not disappointed you wound up with me?" He kept looking at me with those beautiful dark eyes, and then he smiled. I'd heard people talk about dogs smiling before, and I thought they were nuts. But he did. He opened his teeth slightly and pulled up the corner of his mouth. Suddenly, I wasn't feeling sorry for myself. I was thinking about Petey's happiness. "I'm sorry, son," I told him. "I promise. I won't let you down." Over the next weeks, Petey kept pulling harder and harder on the leash, raring to go. There were times when I couldn't keep up, even though I dropped 5 pounds a week pretty consistently since I started the plant-based eating and walking. The misery of headaches, abdominal pain, and overall discomfort I'd lived with for years just disappeared. I felt good, not just better, but really good. I started talking to Petey in a different parks. I started taking Petey to different parks. I found one, Panadeckia Greek Country Club Park, just over a mile from our condo. According to the website, it was home to a stunning pond full of ducks and other wildlife, with golden mountains off in the background. How could something like that exist so close, and I hadn't even known it was there? When we arrived, it was as if Petey had Googled it on his own. He kept choking himself at the end of the leash, trying to run ahead. I picked up my pace the best I could, trying to give him some slack. Thought about how Petey's whole life had just been lived pent up, caged up, or tied to the end of a leash. How could anyone allow a dog to get so out of shape that he didn't even want to run? Changing Petey's diet and taking these walks had freed him. Maybe it was time to let him experience what freedom really felt like. We stopped, and I unhooked his leash. Petey took off like a sprinter at the Olympics, head down, body forward, legs moving so fast they almost overtook him. He flew down the path and didn't slow one bit as he approached the edge of the pond. Instead, he leaped. My jaw dropped open as he sailed over the pond. He must have traveled 7 feet through the air before he landed in a great big belly flop. Petey swam so hard he practically lifted his whole front end right out of the water, beaming with pride and excitement. "Woo-hoo!" I yelled. When he heard me, he swam to the shore, ran out of the water, beelined right to me, and launched into a reverberating full-body shake of biblical proportions. He completely drenched me with mud and pond water, and not for one second did it make me angry. In fact, I laughed. I loved it, and in that moment, I realized I loved him. I was still laughing as he turned around and ran back into the water for another swim. Petey did the swim-to-shore shake-off and ran back in thing about 8 times before I was able to get him to sit and rest for a moment. He was panting like crazy, and between the sparkle in his eyes and the side of his tongue hanging out of his big doggy smile, I knew he was perfectly okay. He looked at me like I was the greatest guy in the world, and that's exactly what I wanted to be for him. I wanted to fulfill Petey's every dream. He'd come into my life, and simply by being here, he rescued me. And in that moment, I felt like the two of us could have done anything. "Want to keep walking?" I asked him. Postscript. O'Gray and Petey walked together for nearly 5 years until Petey died of cancer. Today, O'Gray weighs about 180 pounds, competes in marathons, and trains with his energetic lab mix, Jake. Still to this day, Petey is never far from O'Gray's mind. An award for modesty goes to... I don't deserve a Songwriters Hall of Fame award, but 15 years ago I had a brain operation, and I didn't deserve that either, so I'll keep it. Quincy Jones. All right, ladies and gentlemen, since we are now in what the July-August edition of the Reader's Digest, since the Reader's Digest manages to only do 10 editions a year, we have to run an overlap here for 2 months. So we actually have just finished the June issue, and because I kind of dragged it out a little long. But along with our change in our name, we're also going to start reading the July issue towards the end of July, and hopefully we'll make it all the way through August without having to look for something else to read. Dear reader, Pickled Pink. In second grade, my son Neil had to bring food to class that represented his cultural heritage. As a mutt with forgotten Anglo roots, I had nothing to put forward. But Susan sure did. She brought her hard-boiled egg pickled in beets. No, Susan wasn't raised in a Rust Belt bar or Moe's Tavern from The Simpsons, where a jar of pickled eggs behind the bar is a recurring source of comic relief. Instead, she inherited the stack from her sweet, determined mother, Ruth, who'd been raised Pennsylvania Dutch near the Gettysburg battlefields. There, beet pickled eggs were part of her family's pre-refrigeration existence, as they had been for Hessian soldiers centuries before. Dropping Grandma's ancient food into the 21st century suburban California, however, caused Neil's snarky 8-year-old classmates to react unkindly. I was confused and hurt by several derogatory comments toward the purple pink eggs, he says. They'd always been a staple in our fridge, so the insults cut deep at first. Neil was a sensitive lad, but he also had a tough jock resistance, even then. As he tells it, tongue only partly in cheek, I know instinctively that no other child within hundreds, possibly thousands of miles, regularly ate beef-flavored eggs. These eggs are special, I thought, and so am I. That take-it-or-leave-it attitude towards our local foods is essentially what the American the Tasty is about. That's what this edition is. We love our most distinctive foods from our family heritage or home region, so no matter how others react to it, because it is part of us. I decided those eggs were so freaking weird they were almost cool. And then I'm pretty sure I went down to the schoolyard and proceeded to teach the uncultured swine in my class a lesson about kickball. Bruce Kennedy, Editor-in-Chief. Letters. How to survive anything. After reading about how to survive a bad haircut, I was reminded of a quip my father used to say. What's the difference between a bad haircut and a good haircut? 2 weeks. Mr. Manner suggests that the proper response after passing gas is, pardon me. But a study from the University of Exeter found that being exposed to the gas released in flatulence may help stave off heart attacks, strokes, and dementia. Perhaps the correct response should be, you're welcome. That's from Garrettsville, Ohio. My coma miracle. I'm very curious to learn what happened to the truck driver who caused the accident. The story says a man stopped the fleeing truck after it ran over the woman on the bike. Please tell me he was arrested and punished. From the editors, the truck driver who ran over Colleen Kelly Alexander was ticketed for failing to stop at a stop sign. Alexander's lawsuit against the trucking company to cover her medical bills was settled out of court. Zing. How to craft a comeback. During our teen years, my sister often bested me in arguments. After one defeat, I spent an hour hamming out a smart, scathing response. When I finally hit her with my perfect comeback, she said, I bet it took you all the time to think that up, didn't it? Utter surrender. Norfolk, Virginia. Photo finish. I just saw the camels in your photo caption contest and literally laughed out loud at this one. What do you call a camel without a hump? Hump-free. That's H-U-M-P-H-R-E-Y. Aside an epidemic of broken bones. Your article on osteoporosis was very informative for those of who have been recently diagnosed with this disease. Thank you very much. Second, your letter from a reader, Mary Burns Graham, who wrote about washing and ironing the communion cloth at her church, really struck close to home. My mother also washed the linens at her parish in Stratford, Connecticut, in the 1930s and 40s, and her name was also Mary Burns. Barbara Burns Calder, Huddleston, Virginia. Your mom said what? My wife always inadvertently entertains our kids and me with her mamapropisms. One night we hosted a neighborhood party with people dropping in for food, drinks, and laughter, which were all in abundance. As the party was winding down, the doorbell rang yet again. Mindful of the hour and thinking it's too late for new arrivals, my wife blurted out, it's Lou Tate. Now at my party, when anyone arrives late, Lou Tate's name is invariably leaked, not instead of too late. Hit the hot on the trails of hidden riches. The man who buried a treasure told the story of Forrest Fenn, who hid a chest full of gold and jewels and planted clues to its location in a cryptic poem. Hundreds of people have searched in vain for the bounty. One reader had this idea. The treasure must be at the bottom of Horsetail Falls in Yosemite National Park. The clues are all in the poem. Begin where the warm waters halt and take it to the canyon down. Yosemite is full of canyons. Not far, but too far to walk. Put in below the home of Brown, Grafton Tyler Brown, an artist who painted Yosemite Falls. From there is no place for the meek. The end is ever drawing nigh. Horsetail is a seasonal waterfall. There'll be no paddle up your creek. You can't paddle up a waterfall. Just heavy loads and water high. The waterfall is above your head. If you've been wise and found the blaze, Horsetail Falls look like red at sunset for a few weeks in winter. Look quickly down, your quest to cease. But tarry scant and manual marvel gaze. The firefall is a marvelously fleeting sight. Just take the chest and go to peace. Unless it technically belongs to the National Park Service. Scott Morgan, Largo Floor. Everyday Heroes. A carpenter's memorials have appeared after countless tragedies around the country. This time, this tragedy struck very close to home. His cross is to bear. And there's a picture of a middle-aged gentleman with riding a white hard hat and a blue shirt and blue jeans. Greg Zanis works with Fishman's Groups and reads obituaries to form about each fiction, as he has a series of crosses with red hearts and names on them, on the cross piece. 20 years ago, 15 wooden crosses appeared on a hill overlooking Columbine High School in Littleton, Colorado. It was April 28, 1999, 8 years after a pair of students had shot and killed 12 of their classmates and a teacher before killing themselves. At first, the crosses seemed to be part miracle, part mystery. Before long, their creator stepped forward, Greg Zanis, a carpenter from Sugar Grove, Illinois, who had driven the nearly 1,000 miles to Colorado. Since Columbine, Zanis has built and delivered more than 28,000 crosses, Stars of David and Crescent Moons, too, to communities across America grieving in the wake of violence, natural disasters, and other catastrophes. He brought them to Paradise, California after wildfires wiped out most of the town, Pittsburgh, where 11 worshipers were killed in a synagogue, Sandy Hook, Connecticut, when 26 children and staff were gunned down in their school, and Las Vegas, where 58 people died while enjoying a music festival. One place Zanis, 68, never expected to plant his crosses was in his own backyard. On February 15, 2019, he was in his workshop when he heard sirens scream past his window. He looked out to see dozens of first responders racing down the street. Later that day, he learned that a disgruntled ex-employee had walked into the Henry Pratt Manufacturing Plant in Aurora, Illinois, just 15 minutes from where Zanis lives, and killed five former co-workers. Zanis found himself with the same sickening reaction he'd witnessed in so many towns across the country. How could it have happened here? This is home, he told Chicago Tribune. It was not supposed to happen here. And yet it did. Soon his phone began to ring. When would he set up his crosses? Zanis worked through the night, building five monuments to the deceased. Each was 4 feet tall, weighed about 30 pounds, and featured the victim's name and photo and a big red heart. My simple message is just that the heart on the cross, he told CNN. Love your brother. Love your neighbor. Don't judge them. Life isn't that complicated. Hate and revenge is. Zanis loaded the crosses carefully into the back of his white pickup truck and drove to the plant. He already knew where he'd placed them, on the sidewalk out front next to a chain-link fence. As he always does, he arrived quietly and left without a word. His work was done. Zanis understands more than most how the families feel. He began building crosses to honor his father-in-law, who was murdered in 1996. Tragedy struck him again in 2008 when he buried his 37-year-old daughter, who died of a drug overdose. A few weeks after her death, he was in Parkland, Florida, with 17 crosses and stars he'd made for the victims of Marjorie Stoneman Douglas High School. When I went to Parkland, I was a mess, he told the Tribune, but I can't allow myself to get consumed in my own grief. I'm offering these families hope. It helps me and it helps them. I know that for a fact, because when I leave there, they are smiling. Despite having seen and experienced so much grief, Zanis insists he has no agenda. He isn't advocating for one thing or another. I'm not a gun issue guy. I'm not a church guy, he told the New York Times. There's no interest here other than helping people remember. Everyday heroes. They saved his life and his lawn. On a steamy July day in Bayonet Point, Florida, Gene Work and his brother-in-law, Mac Roker, were resodding Gene's yard. It had grown brown and patchy in the heat, and the Homeowners Association had threatened to impose a hefty fine if the situation wasn't remedied. The new sod was sitting in the driveway on four pallets, but the job was slow going. Gene, then 40, wasn't feeling right. He went inside to take a break and collapsed on the couch, clutching his chest. His wife, Melissa Work, called 911 quickly. Even though he was staring down death, she had one thing on his mind. That lawn. If the sod wasn't put down that day, it would die. While he was having his heart attack, literally in and out of consciousness, he kept begging me to have it put down because he didn't want to go to waste, Melissa wrote on her Facebook post. Soon Pasco Panty Fire and Rescue arrived and took Gene and Melissa to the hospital, leaving Rauco behind to tackle the yard. With an hour, he had managed to remove the old grass. He was about to lay the new sod, which he feared would take him well into the night, when two emergency vehicles appeared, seven men. The same one who had treated his brother got out. Gene had told them how badly he wanted to get the sod down, so they had returned to help. The job was done in under 2 hours, and there's a picture of him doing their thing with a fire engine and an ambulance. Meanwhile, Gene had surgery to insert stents in his heart, alleviating a potential deadly blockage. He's home now, fully recovered, and enjoying his beautiful lawn. The works are still amazed that those EMTs went above and beyond their job description. These men, Melissa told TampaBay.com, saved Gene's life and then came back to save his grass. That's just so awesome. Your true stories in 100 words. My riveting lecture. While putting myself through college, I worked several summers as a rifle range instructor at a Boy Scout camp. since these were true rifles, seriousness and safety were the rule. On the first day of camp, after giving a stern-faced 20-minute lecture on correct shooting procedure, I turned to my campers with a smug sense of a job well done and asked whether there were any questions. At the ready to impart more knowledge, I called on the scout in the back with the raised hand. His question, are those the same shoes you wore last year? Wayne Sanders, Akron, Ohio. Moose on the loose. One day my daughter accidentally left the gate to the swimming pool open, and somehow a moose got into the pool. He was very happy swimming in that warm, clean water. I was not happy at all. I didn't know how to get him out of there. After a lot of screaming and demanding, I decided to ask him nicely, Mr. Moose, would you please walk up those stairs and out that gate? It took him a while, but he finally did, much to my surprise. Sidney Larson, Bountiful, Utah. Thank you for your service. A group of uniformed servicemen were exiting a restaurant as I entered, a group of teacher friends wearing our school shirts. I thanked them for serving our country, and as they walked away, I heard one say, they're the ones who work in the war zone, full of running noses, hacks of paper, and 1,000 questions a day. I prefer my job. Coming from a military family, I was both humbled and amused by our mutual admiration. Stephanie Woodward, Missouri City, Texas. A grateful patient. It took a job as a receptionist for a veterinarian almost 5 decades ago. As an avid animal lover, I accept the position on the condition that I wouldn't have to assist with any wounded animals. I couldn't bear to see any creature in pain. At the end of my first week, we were closing the office for the day when a young man ran up to us holding a severely injured Doberman pincher puppy in his arms and begging us to save his life. The foremost old pup had been hit by a car. The doctor and I ran back into the operating room. The only place the skin was still attached to this poor little animal's body was around one shoulder. The vet worked tirelessly for what seemed like hours, stitching him back together again. That was the easy part. The puppy had broken multiple bones, including his spine. If he survived the next few days, we were quite sure he would never walk again. That day forever changed my life. The veterinarian mentored me, and I became his assistant in all things medical. One of my first jobs was to give that Doberman puppy daily physical therapy. I remember moving his tiny legs to try to keep his muscles from withering. Weeks went by until one day I felt this little figure push back ever so slightly. And he continued to push back all he could, finally use his legs. Fast forward about a year. I walked into the clinic's crowded waiting room and called the name of the next client. Suddenly, a huge Doberman, who had been standing quietly with his owner on the opposite side of the room, broke loose and bolted towards me. I found myself pinned against the wall with this magnificent dog standing on his hind legs, his front paws on my shoulders, washing my face with abundant and joyful kisses. I still tear up in amazement at the display of love and gratitude the dog had for me that day, all those years ago. I went on to be a vet tech for 14 years, and since retirement I volunteered at a no-kill animal shelter. In all the time that has passed and all the experiences I've had, I've never met a dog who didn't know it had been rescued in one way or another. And with that, let's switch over to Consumer Reports. Last week, we were talking about hearing aids and the different benefits to those and things, and I missed one little section that was at the end we didn't have time for, so I'm going to read that now. Hearing helpers for music, phone calls, and TV. Headphones, smartphones, and TVs have functions that may help you hear better whether or not you use hearing aids. Headphones. Choose a noise-canceling model. Headphones with electronics that cancel out background noise can help you hear better and protect your hearing, too. That's because you can listen comfortably with the volume low. One inexpensive option is the Monoprice BT300 ANC, which has an excellent rating from CR for noise-canceling ability. Combine hearing aids with headphones if you want. Larger over-the-ear models make them most likely to fit with a wide range of hearing aids. Smartphones. Sync your phone to your hearing aids. Many hearing aids equipped with Bluetooth can receive audio straight from your smartphone, whether you're making a phone call or listening to music. Check to make sure the devices are compatible. Hear better in a noisy restaurant. If you've synced your hearing aids with your phone, you can turn on Apple's Live Listen feature and then place the phone near your dining companion. His or her voice will be piped into your hearing aids. You can also leave your iPhone near your TV across the room, then listen through your hearing aids. Audiologists say this feature may Help throughout the audio quality is often just so-so. This feature also works with AirPods, Apple's true wireless earphones. Once your phone and hearing devices are paired, you can turn the features on from the control panel. Set this up to the settings, control, custom, and hearing. Get flash notifications. Smartphones can sound a tone to signal a new text message or Facebook post. You can also set many phones to flash so you don't miss an alert, especially in a noisy environment. The real-time text. Most new smartphones use RTT, which works like a combination of a phone call and texting. If you and a friend both have RTT turned on, you can call each other and then use either text or voice to converse. There's no delay as in regular messages, or the text appears on your partner's phone as you type. Turn RTT on under the accessibility settings. TVs. Adjust the sound settings. TV viewers may find it hard to distinguish dialogue, especially in action scenes. Try TV audio settings with names such as dialogue or clear voice. Whether it helps will depend on your hearing, your TV model, and even though if you're watching, if your TV has an on-screen graphic equalizer, try adjusting frequencies to suit your hearing needs. Oh, that's kind of neat. I didn't know that. Experience with volume leveling. This setting adjusts the highs and lows of volume so that you won't strain to hear a movie's intimate conversation or jump out of your skin when a commercial starts. Turning it on or off may help. Spring for a soundbar. Good soundbars can produce clear audio that many versus TVs. ZVox claims that an AccuVoice feature makes it easier to hear dialogue. CR hasn't tested them to find out for sure. Road report. Solution to a sticky situation. Trees app can leave a sticky mess on your vehicles at any time of year, but it can be particularly problematic in warm weather. The heat accelerates how sap sticks to the paint, says John Libinson, chief mechanic at CR's Auto Test. The longer you wait, the harder it is to clean. Clean soap as of sap as soon as possible. Ibison recommends using rubber and alcohol on a soft cloth to remove sap. If that doesn't work, try specialized tree sap or bug around removal product. Be sure to use it sparingly and test it on a small area of paint first. Some can damage the clear coat and possibly the paint itself. Wash off any residue and follow with a full coat of wax. Remove sap from a windshield. Try a plastic scraper. If sap remains, try a razor blade, taking care not to scratch the glass. Why aren't my headlights illuminating the road well? Sometimes, just cleaning headlights with a household glass cleaner is enough to increase their brightness. If that doesn't work, and there's an issue with your vision, the problem may be coating your headlight lenses. The recent AAA study reported that the plastic coating on headlight lenses can start to deteriorate in 3 to 5 years, and can become so clouded or yellowed over time that the headlights provide just 22% of the light they did when new. Drivers need a minimum of 300 to 350 feet to see and react and brake when traveling at 60 miles per hour, says Jennifer Stockberger, Director of Operations at CR's Auto Test Center. If headlights illumination drops 20% of the original brightness, visibility could drop enough to make night driving riskier than it already is. A mechanic can replace the entire headlight assembly, or you can restore the lens coating using a kit sold online or in auto parts stores. If the lenses are clear but the lights are dimmer than they used to be, you may need new bulbs. The vital statistic, 36% reduction in fuel economy at highway speed when a bike rack with two bicycles is placed on a mid-sized sedan. Wow, that's a lot. CR's testing showed that the bike rack reduced the economy by 5 miles per gallon even when it was empty. For maximum mileage, remove the rack when it's not in use or stash inside the vehicle. The hidden risk of used cars. A Consumer Reports investigation found that dealers are selling used cars with open recalls, some of which can be deadly to unsuspecting consumers. Here's how to protect yourself. Armando Vargas Ortega had bought a 2002 Honda Civic just 3 months earlier. While driving on the outskirts of Phoenix one evening, just June, Vargas Ortega collided with a Jeep that had run a stop sign. His wife, in the passenger seat, survived with only minor injuries after her airbag activated, as it's meant to. But Vargas's airbag malfunctions. Instead of cushioning the blow, it ejected a piece of metal, lacerating the carotid artery in his neck, and covering the driver's seat with a copious amount of blood. according to the police report. Vegas Ortega died in the hospital 3 days later. The death is the most recent fatality, the 16th in the U.S. and the 24th worldwide, known to be linked to airbags made by the now bankrupt Japanese car parts manufacturer Takata. A faulty part, the airbag inflator, led to the largest, most complex auto recall in history. The recall now affects 19 automakers and 183 models, covering a total of 56 million airbags in nearly 42 million vehicles. This most recent death highlights not just the ongoing tragedy of a flawed design that can propel deadly shrapnel toward the driver and passengers, but also two common but underappreciated risks faced by the nation's drivers and car buyers. The first is that the systems in place to identify and fix dangerous vehicles are flawed. Vargas Ortega's death occurred because of a safety defect that Honda had issued a recall for years earlier. Today, the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration estimates that unsafe inflator remains unrepaired in nearly 23 million vehicles. Overall, hundreds of recalls are issued every year, 813 alone in 2017. But most recent year with complete data affecting 30.7 million cars, according to NHTSA, and only about two-thirds of recalls get fixed, according to the agency's 2017 analysis. Vargasor death also illustrates how vulnerable used car buyers can be. Honda says that it had mailed 12 recall notices on the vehicle and made 20 phone calls to try to get the car fixed, but it didn't know Vargas Ortega had just recently purchased the Civic. And even though used car dealers routinely repair more minor vehicle problems and cosmetic flaws, no federal law requires them to check for open air recalls or fix safety defects before they see a vehicle. Federal law requires that new car dealerships and car rental companies repair known safety defects, but consumers don't leave the same protection when purchasing used cars, whether they're sold by individual or dealers. There's a clear safety gap, Wallace says, and that puts consumers at risk in a potentially unexpected way. Jared Allen, a spokesman for the National Automobile Dealers Association, says his group encourages franchise and used car dealerships to tell customers when a car they're interested in has an open recall, echoing comments from the trade group that represents independent dealers. Allen also says dealers should try to fix used cars with serious recalls, but he says they shouldn't be required by law to fix all recalls because replacement parts are not always available and because not all recalls are equal and need to be repaired before a buyer leaves the lot. Car safety advocates disagree. There's only one reason it's under a safety recall, and that's because it's unsafe, says Rosemary Shahan, president of Consumers for Auto Reliability and Safety, a national watchdog group based in California. There's now additional protection for rental cars under federal law, Shahan says, arguing that the same protection should apply to used cars as well. CR Special Investigation. To better understand how these problems play out in the real world, Consumer Reports had a team of secret shoppers look into purchasing used cars with known safety defects. CR's car safety experts picked the most serious defects they knew of: Takata airbags in 2001 and 2002 Honda Accords and Civics, which is the one Vegas Ortega drove, as well as those in a 2006 Ford Ranger pickup truck. 13 of the 16 known deaths in the U.S. linked to Takata airbags involved one of those vehicles. NHTSA considers all those vehicles so dangerous that it warns drivers do not drive these vehicles unless you are going straight to a dealer to have them repaired. Ford, in fact, says it will take affected 2006 Rangers to an authorized repair shop to be repaired free of charge. Your CR secret shopper found these risky cars for sale at used car dealers across the country, and few dealers warned them about the danger or offered to fix the car. CR first identified every 2001 and 2002 Honda Civic and Accord and 2006 Ford Ranger listed in Auto Trader and CarCare.com, the nation's two largest website for listing used car. In early 2019, overall, we identified 826 such vehicles, most of which were for sale by independent dealers, not individuals or automaker-owned dealerships. We then ran the vehicle identification number, VIN, for each car through a tool that checks to see whether it still has an open recall. The tool was developed by Carfax, a website that allows users to check repair records of vehicles. We found 102 vehicles, or 12.3%, with open Takata airbag recalls. Some had more than one recall, from both driver's side and passenger side airbags. Certain cars and trucks had other safety defects, too. Overall, 119 vehicles, or 14.4%, had a total of 186 open recalls. AutoTrader and Cars.com, which lists used cars but don't sell them, include language on their sites encouraging users to check on a car's recall status before purchasing it. Cars.com also offers a tool allowing prospective buyers to look for recalls by VIN. What CR secret shoppers call dealers expressing interest in purchasing the list of vehicles, only four of those selling the Ford and none of those selling the Hondas volunteered information that the car was subject to recall or about the danger of the faulty airbag. What used cars dealers said. When our secret shoppers asked directly about the Dakota recall, saying they had heard about it on the news, the dealers' responses varied, with some refusing to fix or even acknowledge the problem. For example, a Richmond Truck Authority in Richmond, Virginia, told our shopper that it couldn't do the repair on the truck because it wasn't a Ford dealer, but that once the truck was sold, it would be done for the new owner free of charge. I can't ever take it to them because, being another dealer, they will charge me for it, our shopper was told. But you being the owner, they will do it for me, for free. But under federal law, recall repairs are free to the legal owner of a vehicle, which includes used car dealers. And Ford spokesperson Monique Bentley says that anyone, including independent dealers, can take any Ford, Lincoln, or Mercury vehicle to an authorized dealership for a recall repair at no charge. When asked for an on-the-record comment, Richard Truck Authority's used car sales manager, who didn't give his full name, said it would be impractical to get all recalls repaired. And in any case, he said, we are pretty short-staffed, adding that he was the only one available to schedule a take car to a franchise dealership for repair. A spokesperson at the National Independent Automobile Dealers Association says the difficulty of getting repairs done is one reason that industry opposes laws requiring that used car dealers repair open recalls. But CR secret shoppers found that certain dealers were willing to make these repairs. For example, when one shopper had about a 2002 Honda Accord at Rich's Car Corner in Seattle, the dealer simply replied, yes, we can do the recall repair. Another secret shopper, calling about a truck at Robertson Ford Lincoln Mazda in Bend, Oregon, got no pushback when asking about the airbag repair. Of course recalls are free, he said, told. It's a standard across the board. We could probably do that for you. A few dealers even volunteered information about the recall. For example, a salesperson at Al's Auto Source in Jenningsburg, Georgia, told one secret shopper that he couldn't even test drive the Ranger he was interested in because of the airbag. You can't drive it to today because Ford called, and they're coming to get the truck, he was told. This is a serious issue. Asked later for an on-the-record comment about the shopper's experience, David DeBar of Al Auto Source said that he always checks for recalls, and he wouldn't advertise a car as safe if it had an open recall. Getting recalled repairs has long been recognized as a challenge, even for models as dangerous as the 3CR looked at. That's partly because the auto industry and its regulator, NHTSA, struggle to reach consumers, especially after a car has been resold. Recall completion rates decline sharply as vehicles age. Vehicles that are 1 to 3 years old have average recall completion rates of 80% plus. For vehicles 6 to 10 years old, only 56% have the work performed. Automakers have taken some steps to expand outreach, reported even using social media, sponsoring public service announcements at sports stadiums, and at least one case hiring private detectives to track down vehicle owners. Congress has also taken steps to improve recall rates by forbidding the sale of new or rental cars with open recalls. In 2015, consumer groups, including Consumer Reports, helped pass for passage of the Rachel and Jacqueline Houck Safe Rental Car Act. The law was named after two sisters, aged 20 and 24, who were killed in a 2004 when their rented Chrysler PT Cruiser caught fire. That car had an open recall for a protected power steering hose. By the same protection, don't apply to used cars, despite calls from numerous advocacy and drive safety groups. That doesn't make sense, says Shahan at Commerce Consumers for Auto Reliability and Safety. She says older used cars with open recalls are the most difficult ones to get fixed. Used car dealers and their trade groups have opposed efforts to require dealers to fix cars with open recalls before selling them. In effect, they say Do & Go's grounds these cars, costing dealers business. It could have a consumer, it could hurt consumers, too, by reducing the value of a trade-in in a car by an average of $1,200, says Jared Allen of the NADA, citing an analysis his organization commissioned from J.D. Power. Several states, spurred by industry-led lobbying campaigns, have tried to protect used car dealers from lawsuits related to recalls. Last year, Tennessee enacted a law saying dealers were, in most cases, protected as long as they disclosed open recalls. Pennsylvania has a similar law. Massachusetts, Missouri, New Jersey, and New York reportedly also have similar measures under consideration. Better protection needed. Consumer advocates, however, say simply disclosing the problem isn't good enough. That puts the burden on the buyer to sort through what needs to be fixed right away and what could wait, says Wallace, CR's policy expert. He says not only that dealers routinely repair cars before selling them, but also that some interact directly with carmakers about other problems. Moreover, the carmakers will make all those repairs free of charge. Removing the danger to consumers is worth any additional step they realistically might have to take, Wallace says. Honda also favors law requiring that used cars be fixed before they're sold, says company spokesman Chris Martin. And while dealers are not required by law to make these repairs, many automakers have policies that forbid their own dealers from selling vehicles with open recalls. We advise our dealers that they should not sell any vehicle, new or used, from any brand with an unrepaired safety recall, Martin says. Similarly, Ford has a used car checklist for its dealers that allows them to check for open recalls and, if any are found, to fix them, says company spokesperson Brentley. That, Wallace said, should be the standard for all used cars. Private individuals sell their personal cars and shouldn't be required to take that step, but they should kick their car's recall status and try to get a problem fixed before selling the car. And for consumers, commercial dealers, both franchise and independent, it should be mandatory. Says Wallace, if there's an open defect, it has to be fixed, period. The tragedy of the Takata airbag failure. In its largest and most complex auto recall in history, but even that description doesn't do justice to the scope and impact of the Takata airbag inflator recall. The recall involves 19 automakers and 183 car models, and the list keeps growing. Just this past fall and winter, several additional recalls, including from Audi, BMW, Jeep, Ford, Honda, Mercedes-Benz, Mazda, Tesla, Toyota, and Volkswagen, added 5.4 million vehicles, bringing the total to 56 million airbags and 42 million cars. And nearly 23 million of these airbags still aren't fixed. The Takata recall also is unprecedented because of the seriousness of the injuries the airbags can cause. The ammonium nitrate, initially used as a propellant in the inflator, sometimes becomes unstable, especially after exposure to repeated temperature changes and moisture from long periods of high humidity. As a result, during a crash, airbags sometimes not only inflate, but also explode, expelling pieces of metal from the inflator itself, causing injuries similar to those sustained in combat. The first Takata airbag recall was in 2008 when the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration became aware of the flaws in the manufacturing process, and the recall was greatly expanded in 2015 with NHTSA organizing the recall by prioritizing the delivery of replacement parts to the most vulnerable cars, the oldest vehicles in the hottest and most humid climates. NHTSA broke the country into three zones based on climate and spaced out the delivery of replacement inflators. The recall announced in the past winter were part of the fourth of unexpected waves and the final push planned for the end of this year. But even then, a problem won't be fully solved. Certain replacement airbags used in early waves were also defective, so some cars will have to have their airbags replaced twice. For example, this March, Honda recalled more than 1.1 million vehicles because of a manufacturing defect in some replacement airbags. To find out whether your vehicle is subject to a Takata airbag recall, go to nhtsa.gov/recalls or see Could Your Car Be Under Recall in this edition of Consumer Reports. Here's a little blurb on how to be a better used car shopper. In most states, used car dealers don't necessarily have to tell you when a vehicle has an open recall. But that's not the only thing you need to worry about when shopping. Here are some tips from our secret shoppers and car buying experts. Check for recalls. Ads often include the vehicle identification number or VIN. Type that into NHTSA's recall tool at nhtsa.gov/recalls. Some used cars website offered a version of that tool, such as the ones at cars.com/recalls. Quiz the dealer. Even if you checked online before going to the lot, ask about recalls. Once you get there, a reputable dealer should share that info, though our secret shoppers found that many dealers don't unless you ask. Negotiate. A dealer might agree to fix the vehicle to make the sale, or you can use the info to ask for a better price. Watch the paperwork. If you're nearing a deal and recalls haven't come up, check the closing papers. As part of a settlement with the Federal Trade Commission, CarMax and some other used car chains must conspicuously disclose vehicles subject to recall if they market them as safe. That could mean simply including the information in one of the documents you sign at closing. Go to cr.org/usedcars to see the most reliable used cars and what models to avoid. And now here's some feedback from an earlier edition. Our May article about robocalls addressed nearly 50 billion calls placed each year and how you can fight back. Readers shared their outrageous anecdotes and smart tips. Your article about robocalls was helpful and informative, but as you note, thus far financial penalties for the perpetrators have proved to be ineffective. The examples you cited indicate that the perpetrators were often unable to pay the fine, but are still walking around. It would seem that advocating imprisonment might improve to be a more effective deterrent. It should be no surprise that robocalls are not going away. Every one of a rogues gallery of robocallers was given a fine, which in several cases was suspended due to inability to pay, until it's made a criminal offense with prison time to operate or knowingly use the services of an illegal robocaller, not much will change. Shortly after your article, my wife saw her father's name and number on her landline caller ID. However, he died 7 years ago. While he may have been calling the hereafter, he did not leave a message. I will sign the FCC petition concerning spoofing and persistent robocallers. I called Verizon the day I received my CR magazine and read your article. In 5 minutes, Verizon set up our phones to block those calls. Can't wait to see if it works. The article was very informative, but I used a different technique with my iPhone. I turned on the Do Not Disturb feature, and next to Allow Calls From, I checked No One. Then I checked Edit in each of my contacts and issued an emergency bypass for both the ringtone and text tone. This means that my phone sounds only when I get a call or a text from contact. While this does not eliminate robocalls, I don't have to listen to them, and I don't concern myself with having to block individual phone numbers and or pay for a service from my provider. Remember, however, these calls or texts that are in emergency bypass mode will sound even when the phone is muted or on vibrate. It seems to me that the robocall epidemic could be easily stopped. A cost-neutral solution for the carriers could be charging by the call and ending unlimited calling. The robocallers would be instantly out of business. The carriers could set the price so that they receive the same revenue as today. With billions fewer calls, they wouldn't need much capacity either. I'd act up for that in a heartbeat. There are always ways around technology. I suggest requiring every telecom carrier to charge for every call made with credit to their monthly bills. So that this mandatory charge is 50 cents, a person with a $50 monthly bill would be allowed 60 calls. But every call after that would cost 50 cents. A robocaller making thousands of calls a day would soon be out of business. One weekend in December 2017, my mobile phone suddenly received perhaps 100 to 200 calls from the random unknown numbers in various parts of the U.S. Some of the callers left messages to the effect that I had called them and hung up. Some were curious, some were angry. I came to realize that a scammer had spoofed my mobile number. I never had any way of knowing who set that up, but then many folks reported my number as a scammer, thus causing the cell service providers to add me to their suspected spam list. Let's hope the promised regulation and new technologies improve things for everybody. Thanks to CR for taking a strong position. Your article does a great job of explaining the reasons behind robocalls and the technological innovations that may stop them. However, I also think this article does not sufficiently emphasize the one weapon we can all use is ignoring and fighting the plague. Hang up. Don't interact with the caller. Don't push any buttons. Don't give any information. If everyone were to adopt a policy of hanging up, all these pests would be one of the business in a short time, thus enabling us to live in peace with our telephones again. Editor's note, our petition to the Federal Communication Commission calling for better protection from intrusive robocalls has more than 200,000 signatures to date. To add your signature, please go to robocallpetitioncr.org, but you can also tweet at FCC to tell the agency you want phone companies to be required to stop unwanted robocalls using the hashtag end robocalls. If we truly need to do everything possible to address, we're switching subjects here. If we truly intend to do everything possible to address the opioid epidemic, CBD must be fast-tracked for research supported by the Food and Drug Administration. Good point. Car safety solutions. I enjoyed the article, Can We Save More Lives? But I wish there were more information on the crash test dummy of the future. It is my understanding that crash test dummies are built with male proportions, weight, and weight distribution. Having been female for nearly 70 years now, I can attest that seatbelts do not adjust for a woman put at their lowest height. Still, they cross my body at an uncomfortable places and up 5'6" tall. Dummies in male, female, and child proportions are used in crash testing, but those dummies are not typically used for assessing seat comfort, belt fit, and controls. CR evaluates cars with that in mind, using a range of testing from 5 foot tall women to 6 foot 3 inch men. We also advise consumers to look for a car with adjustable upper belt anchors, power seats, and tilt and telescoping wheel adjustments. According to the Sleep and Neuroimaging Lab at the University of California, Berkeley, drowsy driving causes more crashes than alcohol and drug-related crashes combined. Based on driving stimulator studies, a person going to work at 7 a.m. and going out with friends until 2 a.m., consuming no alcohol, is as cognitively impaired to operate a vehicle as a legally drunk driver. This technology to detect drowsy driving is available and of moderate cost, gaze detection. If cars were equipped with the technology that could track the driver's eyes, that would address both the problem of drowsy driving and, as a bonus, detect distracted driving, as well as implementing the alert system based on gaze detection, could reduce crashes by an order of magnitude more than worrying existing DUI laws. Hands-free cell phones use no safer than holding the phone to your ear. Where your mind is more important. I'd rather see who is on the phone so I can be extra aware of the car. Perhaps a light on the roof of the car could show everyone a phone is in use. Very good idea. I'm amazed at the growing... Oh, I'm sorry. We're about to run out of time. My apologies. I got wrapped up in it. Thanks for listening. Bye.